We continue now with The Virtue of Trust by Paul D. Yeager, S.J. Trust in Desolation. We have the right to sigh for the beloved's return. Ought we then to prevent ourselves from sighing for the return of Jesus if he bids us sigh for him? No, for these loving sighs are the evidence of our love. They are wholly pleasing in the sight of Jesus. All the saints have known these ardent desires, have wept these tears of a desolate soul. Those lovely lines of Saint Bernard will be recollected. O sweetest Jesus, thou hope of my languishing soul, it is thou whom my pious tears seek out. It is thou after whom from the secret places of my soul I cry aloud. Let the grace implicit in these words be our guide. At times we shall choose to surrender ourselves and to make a loving trust our soul's sweet pillow. At other times we shall awaken from our sleep and in love shall stretch forth our arms towards him whom our heart so fervently desires. Desolation urges us to draw upon the treasures of Jesus, our divine sufficiency, who lives in us. As we've clearly seen, desolation has good title to our esteem and to our love. If we be thoroughly convinced of this in hours of tranquility and peace, this conviction will be our great strength in hours of spiritual ordeal. Nevertheless, it can and does often happen that such reflection seems in no way to help us in the sufferings and anxieties of desolation. Possibly, it's the will of Jesus that we should seek safe sanctuary in his divine heart. When we're aware of ourselves as poor, sad, loveless, spiritually numb, when we imagine ourselves to have nothing to offer to God, then, weary with struggling, almost instinctively, we turn towards Jesus. True as this is for all of us, it is especially true of those happy souls who endeavor to live the life of identification with Christ. Finding in hours of spiritual barrenness in themselves everything that is poor, wretched, and repulsive, they naturally look to Jesus, their divine sufficiency in adoration, in reparation, and above all, in love. They recollect that they are not alone in their life and their love for God, but that they live in union with and for Jesus. They know that their life is only the life of Jesus dwelling within them, and that Jesus makes use of them to love and to adore the Father. In consolation, there are times when he manifests his life more obviously. A spark from the great furnace of the love of Jesus has been kindled in their own heart and possesses them with its sweet consuming fire. Normally, they're scarcely conscious of the love of Jesus in themselves, though they clearly perceive that the very beating of the heart of Jesus is his unchanging love of the Father abiding within them. Jesus has made no withdrawal of himself. In reality, the soul is even now not left alone to serve, to love, and to adore the Father. It is simply that Jesus has hidden himself in the soul's secret depth, and from that living altar makes ascend towards the eternal the incense of his pure love. You are no longer conscious of the love of Jesus quickening your faculties and binding them with its spell, that in you he may love the Father. No matter, Jesus is forever there in the depths of your heart. Where once you felt generosity, a thirst for self-sacrifice, a thirst for trust, a thirst for love, you feel now only spiritual languor and sterility. What does this imply? Yours is something far finer than these miserable perfections, in which, in consolation, you too frequently put overmuch trust. Yours are those ineffable perfections of Jesus who lives within you. Instead of the paste and the imitation pearls which your own poor virtues are, you can make offerings to God of the precious rubies and the magnificent diamonds of the virtues of Jesus. You can offer him his profound humility, his perfect trust, His utter selflessness, His limitless love. In this lies your true consolation, unaware of it though you may be. In the last resort, in this lies too your greatest means of finding grace in God's sight, of making yourself well-pleasing in His eyes, and of offering Him a blessed and unblemished host that shall be worthy of Him. Blessed be that desolation which sends you thus to the true treasure of your soul, and enables you to discover in your extreme poverty your immense riches. The true conception of desolation, no less than the springtime of consolation, its winter is necessary to the spiritual life. Under whatever form we meet it, whether as aridity, sadness, or obscurity, the impossibility of praying or aversion to things of the Spirit, let us make it our constant endeavor to have of desolation an increasingly true and exact conception. Let us realize that desolations are essential to the divine workman, whose whole effort is bent towards ridding our soul of its vain stone of impurity, in order to convert it into a diamond worthy of His Heavenly Father. Many souls, whose spiritual experience is limited, imagine desolation to be a punishment, as consolation was a reward of their sacrifices and their generosity. This is a complete delusion. There are times, doubtless, when this can be true, above all at the beginning of the spiritual life, yet far more often, in God's plan, desolation is a special mark of love, a grace which is to lead us onward and upward, and to bring us near to ultimate union. If we are unaware of any particular fault or infidelity, we are ill-advised to torment our soul with constant introspection, with restless self-examination. If we will, let us humble ourselves. Let us ask the Lord's pardon for all those faults that we've committed in ignorance. But then, let us straightway expand our soul with loving trust. For at these times we have great need of such trust, that we may remain faithful to our resolutions, that we may not change our mode of life, and that we may not seek consolations among creatures to compensate ourselves for those which the Creator no longer gives us. We need all our soul's energies if we are to profit truly from this precious time and to fulfill the plans which God has for us. A footnote. On this subject, we cannot afford to forget the golden rule which Saint Ignatius, that great master of the spiritual life, has given us in his rules upon the discernment of spirits. This is that hours of desolation are not propitious for cool judgment, and that in them we must not alter our former resolutions or mode of action. To continue, normally desolation is not a punishment for our follies and our infidelities. It is a precious and necessary means of purification. The divine consolations reveal to us the perfections and the lovableness of God, that we may be kindled with love for Him. Spiritual desolations discover to us all our inherent poverty, all our repulsiveness, that we may know a profound disgust for ourselves and may be inspired with a holy hatred of self. Here, then, are the indispensable springs and winters of the spiritual life. These alternating spiritual seasons are mostly planned by God that we may be led to perfect union and to true holiness. He varies them in nature and in length according to the needs of our soul. We have no cause then to grow sad of heart when desolation is of long continuance. On these occasions we are easily tempted to imagine that we're losing precious time. We who would run with glad heart in the spiritual way in the beloved company of Jesus suddenly perceive that Jesus has disappeared. He seems to have forgotten us, left us to ourselves, so that consequently we make no progress. Let us undeceive ourselves. Jesus does not forget us. Of our love, he is more desirous than we are. Infinitely more than we, he yearns for our holiness. His apparent forgetfulness is a precious grace. He works now in the depths of our soul that he may purify us, may remove from us all obstacles to divine union. He works ceaselessly both day and night with a tireless patience and an immense desire. Useless branches he prunes and lops. He makes winter follow spring and summer. He allows the flowers to fall one by one and stores the fruit which he perceives to be ripe. He knows that the trees grow, that each return of spring will bring new flowers and fruit more delicious than before, till the day shall come when in our soul he can harvest the fruit of perfect love. In desolation, Jesus is indulgent towards our weakness. In conclusion, let us not forget that Jesus is infinitely good, indulgent, and compassionate. If in our spiritual ordeals we are somewhat lacking in generosity, if there be times when in a measure we relax, let us not think that all is lost and that Jesus is displeased with us. Jesus knows how to take the long view of our difficulties, of our repugnancies and our weaknesses, while if broadly we do our utmost, he does not hesitate to close his eyes, ignoring our minor faults. Let us not sadden ourselves by saying, "In desolation I lack generosity. It is true that I bear my cross, yet it is with no stout heart that I bear it, but rather as though I were about to fall beneath its weight. Of how many petty faults I am guilty, of how many reversions to the life of the natural man. How different it is in times of consolation. Jesus knows all this better than ourselves, and if despite his knowledge he sends us his spiritual ordeals, it is because he looks for rich results from them. It is because our petty faults are on the whole balanced by our general attitude of resignation, of self-surrender, and of humility. We know that to them that love God, all things work together for good. If only we keep faithful our love for Jesus and preserve a keen desire to love him always more abundantly, despite our petty faults, spiritual ordeals will be salutary for us, and alternating with consolations will lead us insensibly towards high perfection. Chapter 16. Trust in the Spiritual Nights. Mystical is not a synonym for extraordinary. This, said for the comfort and consolation of souls plunged deep in desolation, holds good in the varying kinds of spiritual ordeal known by the generic term desolation. There is, too, a special kind of ordeal known to mystical souls, an ordeal particularly disconcerting no less for its nature and for its intensity than for its duration. Souls that God has plunged into these ordeals are particularly worthy of compassion. They need to be given more often and more especially comfort and new courage, that they may be able to endure as they should these crucifying ordeals. We are dealing here with the mystical life. For some, the very word mystical is a bugbear. Because of this, we need to make an initial remark that we may obviate errors and possibly dissipate certain prejudices. The mystical life does not imply, as so many imagine, the extraordinary life. That great saint of our times, Teresa of the Child Jesus, attained to the most exalted peaks of the mystical life and of holiness. Nevertheless, the most extraordinary thing in her life was its apparent absence of anything extraordinary. She was at pains to say again and again that her new life of loving trust, her way of a little child, contained nothing that was extraordinary. With her, there were neither visions nor revelations. To the best of our belief, with her, there were not even ecstasies. Here was a wholly ordinary life, passed for the greater part in spiritual sterility and desolation. In its essence, the mystical life in no wise consists of these phenomena that are its accidental concomitants, visions, raptures, ecstasies, supernatural utterances. It consists in the growing enrichments of the gifts of the Holy Ghost, the gifts which leave us increasingly passive under the action of grace, and thus give God a stronger and stronger hold upon our life. This enrichment is the result of special and gratuitous graces called operative graces, and is wholly without our own reach. We can prepare ourselves to receive them, we cannot induce them. To speak more specifically of mystical contemplation, this must not be confused with mystical life. It is essentially a light infused into the intelligence and a love infused into the will, due to the inpouring of the gifts of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. In other words, infused or mystical contemplation is a simple and loving and normally a confused and general concentration of the soul upon God and things divine. With it, there are alternatives. It can exist solely at hours of formal prayer, or it can thoroughly impregnate one or more of our actions, or even our entire day, maintaining us in a more or less continuous loving union with God. The mystical life, then, has nothing about it which need terrify us. Many men are mystics, yet exteriorly do not differ in any respect from their fellows. At most, possibly exteriorly, they suggest a trifle more of recollection than others. None suspect the ways by which they walk. Read the life of St. Teresa of the Child Jesus, and scrutinize it as you will discover no evidence in it of the mystic ways. It requires a practiced eye to discover indications of these. Usually, not only do we fail to suspect those mystical souls which live at our side, but these souls themselves, particularly at the beginning of the mystical life, have no consciousness of their state. Probably they would make sincere protest were they taxed with being mystics. The main stages of the mystical life. What then are the main stages of the mystical life, as they are generally encountered and as they've been admirably described in his Dark Night by that doctor of mysticism, St. John of the Cross? First of all, there is the night of the senses, one purpose of which is to detach the soul from all things of the senses and to make it capable of contemplation. This night can last many years. It is normally followed by a period of peace and of vivid consolations. After this, the soul which God destines for final union enters upon the night of the spirit, whose aim is to purify completely the soul's spiritual part and to lead the latter into holiness. Let us examine each of these three main stages, making the initial remark that God is bound by no law and that in practice every case is different from every other. At the beginning of the spiritual life, generally, although not invariably, God gives consolations at once more rich and vivid in that he desires to lead the soul to higher things. In this way, he seeks to detach it from all those human joys that are negligible in comparison with the intimate joys of divine love. Subsequently, when he perceives the soul to be sufficiently detached from earthly consolations, he begins to deprive it of the conscious joys of the spirit. Gradually, he takes from it the inclination and the pleasure which it feels in performing acts of virtue, acts of charity, acts of humility, and mortification. He filches from it, too, the joys of prayer. Without exaggerating too greatly the change wrought in it, the soul begins to experience considerable difficulty in meditating, in praying as before by the use of the intellect. For this, it feels a secret aversion. Beneath the action of God, its whole life is simplified. Its spiritual activity seems to grow strangely less. Whereas it loved formerly to express itself in prayer, in varying sentiments of humility, of mortification, of trust, of self-denial, of love of God, it feels itself impelled to talk in all simplicity with God, or even to remain near Him in the simple and peaceable attitude of trusting love, like a child in the arms of its mother. Reflex acts have as little attraction for it as it has facility for them. Gradually and secretly, God favors it with the gift of infused prayer or of contemplation. With only a vague perception of the means, from time to time it feels, now in prayer, now otherwise, united to Him in a general, faint, yet loving concentration upon God, its beloved. It is this sorrowful transition from the ordinary life to the mystical life, and from meditation to contemplation, which is called the night of the senses. Its days are days of secret suffering, of sorrowful spoilation of soul. The soul, deprived of conscious spiritual joys, is yet not skilled in relishing the purer and more secret spiritual joys which contemplation offers. Desolation and aridity seem to possess it utterly. It looks upon itself as idle and inactive, as given over to the deadness of routine. Moreover, these years of the night of the senses are the more painful in that the soul does not take into full account the divine action of God. Wistful of drawing near to God that later it may know union with Him, at the moment it imagines itself to be in a constant state of retrogression. Where now, it asks itself, are its fervent and undistracted prayers, its desire for suffering, its absorbing transports of love? Further, it is even possible that its spiritual director, himself not guessing at the essential change which is taking place in it, merely increases its anguish by urging it to its old-time generosity. It frequently happens that the soul, sighing for its initial conscious fervor, makes sorrowful efforts to return to its former modes of prayer, its sequent logic, and its feverishly agitated spiritual activity. Yet, these efforts that counter the action of God succeed only in aggravating its discomfort and its suffering. Again, to make the situation yet more poignant and agonizing, it seems to it that the day of its deliverance will never dawn. How shall it survive this ordeal? What knowledge has it of the ordeal itself? In fact, is it sure that it is indeed an ordeal? Were it only sure, this would in itself be a great consolation. For the ordeal, long as it is, seems endless. It lasts for years, sometimes few, sometimes many, according to the plan of God. The intensity of the night, the degree of perfection to which God would have the soul attain, its docility under God's purifying action, the grossness of the imperfections of which it needs to be purified, these are so many factors which affect its duration. Undoubtedly, the night does not remain uniformly dreadful. There are times when the winds drop. There are other times when the storm redoubles its fury. It can be said that normally, this sorrowful and purifying ordeal lasts several years. The soul is without power to set a term to it. Neither by the use of skill nor by the taking of thought can it set itself free. God purifies us much as gold is purified in a crucible. When the desired degree of purity is attained, then once more the radiant day will break and God will invite the soul anew to the joys of the divine love. For winter is now past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers have appeared in our land. Arise, my love, my beautiful one, and come. Usually, says St. John of the Cross, God then accords the soul a respite, often of several years. He gives it to relish anew and at length His divine consolation. but more purely, more nobly, more spiritually than before. It is in the most secret places of the soul that he makes revelation of himself. It is there that with the words inaudible to the senses, he floods the soul with infused and exquisite lights and holds it spellbound by the charm of his divine lovableness. It is there that he puts love's fetters upon it. He makes his beloved presence once more known to it, though in a manner much more intimate than before. Consequently, there are times when love overwhelms it. It cannot contain its raptures and breaks into ardent transports. At other times, it keeps silence, sleeping peacefully and lovingly upon the breast of its beloved God. Thus, with each new day, it attaches itself more straitly, more indissolubly to him. Moreover, trust grows proportionately with love. God makes the soul so well aware of his exquisite goodness that it responds by protestations of eternal fidelity and of blind trust in him. These are the fat years during which it makes ample provision of trust for the lean years. It lays in reserves of strength for the supreme ordeal now imminent, if it be destined to mount still higher. For though many souls pass through the night of the senses, it is only too few, mystical authorities declare, of the number of faithful and generous souls whom God submits to the final and decisive ordeal, which is to lead to transforming union and to true holiness. At the hour willed by God, the soul enters once more into the night, the dreadful night of the Spirit, which brings with it supreme passive purification. Only those who have known the terrors of the sorrowful night can relish the full anguish of this great ordeal. It is purgatory upon earth, which, to quote St. John of the Cross, takes the place of purgatory awaiting us in the other life. In its spiritual part, above all, in its intelligence, memory, will, the soul is now purified. Its theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, chiefly due to the gift of understanding, are rid of the last and the least of its imperfections. To its old modes of action, based upon its human and natural self, the soul must die completely. It is truly nourished upon the bread of sorrow with the gall of tribulation. With the prophet David, it can cry, "Save me, O God, for the waters are come in even unto my soul. I stick fast in the mire of the deep. There is no sure standing. I am come into the depth of the sea, and a tempest hath overwhelmed me. My eyes have failed whilst I hope in my God." There are times when the night is so black, when the darkness is so thick, that the soul finds it difficult to remember the sunny days of yesteryear. In place of that passive and infused sentiment of the presence of God, which is so dear to it and which kindles it with love, it has only the consciousness of his absence. To intimacy with him succeeds a boding silence. In vain it seeks him. In vain it calls aloud to him. In vain it stretches out towards him and the arms of its vast desires. From him it has no answer. Everywhere I have sought him whom my soul loveth, I have sought him and found him not. It is still truer of the night of the senses that the soul has a strong conviction and a clear consciousness of its retrogression. At times, it believes itself about to fall headlong into the abyss. Giddiness seizes it. It imagines itself to be destined to hell. If these ultimate agonies are infrequent, yet often it seems to be displeasing to God, to have irritated God, to have forfeited his desire for its love. Moreover, is it not altogether right as to this? How could he love with a pure love so repulsive a creature? How could he contemplate a union of himself with that which is merely egoistic pride? It has an unassailable conviction that God no longer loves it, and that it too no longer loves God. The divine fire which once burnt in its heart is quenched. This is daylight clear to it, and it is in vain that perpetually it seeks to light that fire again. Yet, if the manifestations of the divine love be no longer evident, unknown to the soul, God has instilled in it a new love of vast depth. God, hidden though he be, seems to it both lovable and worthy to be loved. Without permitting it to know the dear delight of his divine lovableness, God nevertheless draws it to himself. How it would love to the limit of love this unique and infinite lovableness which is God. It would love him, utterly love him, but from the abyss of its night there comes an ominous voice. You are not worthy of loving the infinite. He no longer loves you, and you no longer love him. For you, this is the end of love. Of this it is only too sadly convinced, although in the depth of its secret soul there perpetually flickers a gleam of hope that is an inner assurance of the contrary, but in this it dare not place its trust. What anguish of love is known to this soul? What strange torture! Its immense desires to love, its overburdening griefs, are in themselves a great love made manifest. Yet, blinded as it is by purifications, a little as is the owl by the too strong light of day, it cannot perceive this. Possibly the soul's directors perceive this clearly and state it precisely. Yet how shall the soul dare to believe in that which by some strange magic appears to it as patently untrue? It loves God vastly, wildly, yet at the same time believes and feels itself to be stripped of all love. Like Angela of Foligno, it would exclaim, "Alas, when I behold the love with which God has loved me, my own love is no more than a weak jest and an abominable lie." That is the most burdensome affliction of this night. Compared with that, all the rest, painful though it be, is as nothing. This affliction is a foretaste of hell's horrors, of the fate of the damned. The soul knows what Jesus knew upon the cross when he cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" This second night, too, lasts years. Usually, for a considerable period, the ordeal is pure bitterness. In it is no whit of consolation. Yet, after it, the great work of purification now perfected, the soul begins to breathe again. From time to time, glimmerings of dawn streak the horizon. For brief moments, God, the great hidden God, makes himself manifest and gives the soul new ecstasies of happiness. It begins to be conscious of its vast love for God. The anxiety and anguish of its own love disappears, yet the soul remains pierced with the love of God. Its great grief is now, and will continue to be, its inability, despite its extreme love for God, to love him in a measure worthily, to love him as he desires to be loved, to love him for himself, and, with apostolate's aid, to love him no less for others. An insatiable thirst for love will torture it ceaselessly, while simultaneously the contrast between the perfections of God and its own incredible repulsiveness will detach it utterly from the self. Thus, gradually, will purification be perfected, and the night change by degrees into the dazzling day of transforming union and of perfect love. From this ordeal, the soul issues transformed and impregnated with God. In it, God lives abundantly. He has substituted for its previous activity his own. Features of the Night of the Senses. We will not discuss in further detail these passive purifications. The souls which God leads in these ways can, if they wish it, and with their director's approbation, read the Dark Night of St. John of the Cross. Here we will content ourselves with a few reflections. In the first place, how can it be discerned with certainty whether a soul is in the night of the senses and not merely exposed to spiritual sterility caused by faint-heartedness and so forth? St. John of the Cross notes for us three characteristic signs that are indeed valuable and that must be taken conjointly to establish beyond doubt the desired distinction. First sign. In the night of the senses, there is to be found no delight, no consolation in divine things, and scarcely more in created things, for the gift of knowledge is strong upon the soul, revealing to it the vanity of all things. Second sign. In the night of the senses, the soul usually clings to the remembrance of God with a painful care and solicitude, due to the fear of retrogression and arising from its lack of relish for divine things. The gift of fear is revealed in this. This lively care is a plain sign that this spiritual barrenness is not the effect of faint-heartedness or of spiritual sickness. It is brought about because God transfers health and strength from the senses to the soul. The senses are wholly starved, but the soul begins to find new nourishment. The latter, in the beginning, makes small response, its spiritual palate being yet unused to this new and subtle savor. This spiritual nourishment takes the form of the beginning of an obscure and austere contemplation. Third sign. This is the difficulty of meditating as formerly by having recourse to the imaginative sense. The reason for this is that God is beginning to communicate himself, no longer by the senses or by the reason, but by the means of pure spirit, which ignores discursive sequence and in which God communicates himself in the act of simple contemplation. The gift of understanding now initiates us into a wholly superior knowledge of God. It is to this that the soul's inclinations turn. It finds it easy to dwell in simplicity near to God. It is content to find itself alone with him without giving itself up to discursive acts or sequent thoughts. Difficulty in meditation, which is the third sign, is more or less customary and tends to increase. Nevertheless, it knows variation. At some hours it is more pronounced than at others. In the night of the senses, this state of the soul, therefore, is characterized by two negative features: aridity, or deprivation of all conscious consolation, and the difficulty of meditation. Added to this is one positive feature, the beginning of infused contemplation and the living desire for God which it arouses in us. Further, it is this positive element that is the cause of the two negative features. Let this be noted. This aridity and this difficulty of meditation are due to the fact that grace is taking a new and more spiritual form above the plane of the senses and of the imagination. God deprives us of sensual gratification, substituting for it a nobler gratification, which, however, brings us no delight until we have gradually grown accustomed to it. So it is with a child whom his mother has just weaned. His small teeth find it painful to bite the more substantial food, yet this pain is the gateway to stronger nourishment whose savor he slowly comes to relish. It is not hard, therefore, to understand why the soul which passes through the night of the senses, although knowing merely distaste and sterility in prayer, nevertheless instinctively clings to a vague and general remembrance of God. It is haunted by the thought of God. It hungers for him. Better than all things else, this proves that this sterility is not the effect of lukewarmness. God's purpose explains the sufferings of these nights. Our next concern is to understand the end which God pursues in these nights and to keep it consistently in mind. God strips the soul of all that is barrier to union. A footnote. St. John of the Cross emphatically and repeatedly points out that the night of the senses and still more the night of the Spirit, are essential for perfect purification, which is required for union. These alone can wholly purify the secret recesses of our soul. To continue, he would lead it to perfect union. To effect this, he must remove all barriers to this union, must detach the soul from all things, that he may attach it to himself alone. As St. John of the Cross says, to attain wholly to God, who is all, you must wholly renounce yourself in all things. Again, with souls whom God has already in a measure detached from material goods by means of his spiritual consolations, these same consolations, in that they retain an element of the senses, easily provide opportunities of harmful attachment. The soul, instead of searching single-heartedly for God, seeks rather his gifts. As Blessed Henry Suso strikingly points out in his book, The Nine Rocks, attachment to consolations is a great stumbling block to divine union. In the night of the senses, therefore, God deprives the soul utterly of every conscious spiritual joy, of every delight in the divine love. He plunges it into conscious aridity and accustoms it to a spiritual life yet more freed from the wheel of the senses, of the imagination, and of the reason. Let us continue with trust in the spiritual nights on the next tape.